Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Columbus City Schools officially desegregated on September 6, 1979. But desegregation didn't make the inequities suddenly disappear. Ohio State professor Simone C. Drake recently wrote a book called Becoming Educated, A Midwest Story. It walks through her experience as a young Black woman who was just starting kindergarten in 1980 here in Columbus. The book is about her experience as a young Black woman in the 80s going through the recently desegregated Columbus City School system. And Professor Drake joins us today. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me.
So your book goes through your experience as a young Black girl in Columbus City schools. During your time, the school had become integrated. You had Black teachers, you had white friends. However, there were still some underlying inequalities. Can you share some examples of what you experienced as a young girl in school?
Well, this book started out as a very different book. It started I decided to go to law school while I was a professor, and I was being very pragmatic and writing papers that connected to an interest I had on how Black middle-class parents make educational choices for their children. And I don't know, then maybe around 2017, 2018, I decided to do a creative nonfiction program at the Kenyon Review's Writers Workshop in the summer. And then the next year, I got a fellowship at the National Gallery of Art Center for the Advanced Study in Visual Art. And I started writing parts of this book, but even then it wasn't supposed to be a book. Mm-hmm. But different things led to other things. I ended up producing a documentary called Shut Down about the 1971 closing of Lyndon McKinley High School due to racial unrest. My parents graduated from there. I grew up in South London. And so just kind of organically and randomly, there's a point where I just decided, I like writing this way. It's different than the academic writing that I've been doing for previous books. And the stories just started flowing. Mm. So
yeah,
that's how it came to be.
The book is about your experience as a young Black woman in the 80s going through a recently desegregated Columbus City school system. So during the time your school had become integrated, you had Black teachers and white friends. However, there were still inequities. So can you tell us just a little bit about, you were about to tell us about being in kindergarten mm-hmm. at Oakland Park Elementary. Can you tell us about some of those experiences as a young girl?
Yes. So I would say in elementary school, I was somewhat oblivious to what was going on politically and socially. But one thing that I think even the integration couldn't address is that the neighborhoods, for the most part, remained segregated racially. So I grew up in South London, and pretty much all of my neighbors were African American. I had a lot of friends who lived in Clintonville, and I think pretty much all of their neighbors were white. So, so this, the law had its limits. It could change, with just sort of the dynamics of the country.
Well, and also there were quite a few pop culture references throughout your book. What made you decide to include that element in the book, just to make it different?
No, well, I study and I publish and I teach on popular culture among a variety of other topics. And it just seemed to make sense to me. I mean, so much of our lives are informed or experienced within popular culture. And I did a lot of sort of like memory type of exercises or memory work to write the book. That a lot of the things that I wrote about weren't necessarily things I just think about on a regular basis. And popular culture is a useful device, music, film, for conjuring up the memory and for making the connections.
In your book, you talk about the ways Black girls were treated differently, especially when it came to education. Can you tell us about some things that you were told in comparison to maybe your brother?
Well, as far as education goes, I feel like my parents didn't really have gendered divisions in that regard. There were lots of rules, though, that were very different between my brother and I, and also related to school, especially as I got older, with things like dating or things I could do with my friends or couldn't do that very much were about me being a girl. In school, I would say maybe by high school, I did notice that there were things, and some of this might be in retrospect, but certainly I didn't in high school. I did not really understand what engineering was. But in AP chemistry, the boys would talk about engineering. Very few girls talked about engineering, yet we were in the same classes, doing the same work, and probably some of us getting better grades than the boys. So I can't recall anything explicit from the teachers or the administration about what girls should or should not do or study. I think there were still some attitudes that were just sort of implicitly embedded in how we were taught.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the memoir Becoming Educated, A Midwest Story, with author and Ohio State professor Simone C. Drake. You went on to Denison University, which was predominantly white. You did not want to go to an HBCU. Can you tell us about that stage of your life?
Sure. My mother chose Denison University for me. I had another school I wanted to go to, and I think they called after I'd already accepted somewhere else and said they still had my scholarship. And next thing I know, that's where I was going. and it was racial demographics have changed a lot since I started in 1993. But yes, it was a very, very small percentage of just non-white students in general. As far as an HBCU, it's interesting because most of my family that is from the South, largely from Georgia, pretty much everyone attended an HBCU, but I didn't grow up having a real strong connection with that side of my family because my grandfather was in the military. So that's how my family on my mother's side ended up in Columbus. It was his last, the Rickenbacker, or the Lockbourne Air Force Base was his last military assignment before retirement. And also I think the students that were very much for going to HBCUs sometimes were the ones that critiqued me the most for whether I acted Black enough or looked Black enough, sounded Black enough. And so at that time that was sort of my association it was a space where maybe I wouldn't be accepted. I very much changed my attitude as a parent and encouraged my children to definitely consider HBCUs.
Yeah, that was my next question. Your memoir extends to when you finally had your own children. So how did your experiences growing up and what you wrote about influence the way you're approaching school with your own kids?
Well, initially I wanted to replicate my experience. I wanted my children to have my experience, and my experience going through Columbus Public Schools was overall a good experience. But the schools had changed. We had a significant U.S. Supreme Court case in 1996 that changed the court mandate for integration. And also I didn't live in the neighborhood I grew up in anymore. And so there was just it became very complicated in ways that I had just imagine through rose-colored glasses. I guess it was going to be so simple. And we had also, before having children, moved back here from like the Washington, D.C. metro area, which is very different than central Ohio. And so I was just always kind of searching for, I don't know if it still exists or not. And just also where they would be safe, like psychically safe. And I think that is why I initially started a very different project for this book when I was in law school.
Overall, so you've written this book. Overall, what do you hope people take away from the book? Like, what's the biggest takeaway that you hope people get after reading your memoir?
That there are many different ways and places in which we become educated. Because a lot of the book, I call them vignettes, they're so short, not chapters. A lot of them do not take place inside a traditional classroom space, educational classroom space. And so that we're always learning, we're always becoming educated in various spaces and walks of life. And so I think that's to me what the book is really about. Yes, it is about the integration experience and then parenting, but it's also all of the things that I keep learning in life, and will continue to learn.
We've been talking to Ohio State professor and author Simone C. Drake about her recent memoir, Becoming Educated, A Midwest Story. Thanks so much for joining us today, Simone.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk to the executive director of the Knorr Community Clinic, which provides primary care services to the underinsured. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. The Knorr Community Clinic opened its doors in 2010 with a mission to be a primary care provider for patients who lack access to traditional healthcare providers. Dr. Malika Huck founded the clinic and as a pediatrician for over 20 years at the nationwide clinic professor of pediatrics at Ohio State University. And she joins us today to tell us about the clinic and her work. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Huck.
My pleasure.
So tell me about the Knorr Community Clinic. It's affiliated with the Knorr Islamic Cultural Center in Hilliard. How did it come about all those years ago? How did you end up starting this community clinic?
First and foremost, I'd like to greet with my Islamic greetings, Assalamu alaikum, which is peace be upon you. It has been a fascinating story about the birth of the Knorr Community Clinic. The Knorr Community Clinic is also known as the Muslim Clinic of Ohio. And a group of physicians and healthcare providers, I always had this idea about serving the underserved right from my early childhood. And during my internship, I'm from India. And my husband and I, after our marriage, came here in 1967. And then following that, I did my all the internships and fellowships, and finally settled down as a pediatrician and worked for 35-some years at Nationwide Children's Hospital, one of the largest hospitals in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And also I was a fellow at Ohio State University College of Medicine in the first year, that is 1970 to 71, and did my fellowship in developmental disabilities and mental retardation. And I served as a primary care physician for children in the underserved areas of Nationwide Children's Hospital and built the first clinic, full-time primary care clinic. And then in 1973 to 74, and then later on, we have many other clinics that were established in succession to that. But I was the first one to establish the primary care clinic at Nationwide Children's Hospital in the community, and therefore had a lot of experience. So this idea of having the Muslim physicians get together and come up with this Noor Community Clinic was always there in my head, because my father wanted me to serve the underserved. And because when he graduated, he presented me with a gold, with a diamond ring, and said, the richest have the best care in the world, but the poor don't have any. So you are going to take care of the poor. So when this idea came, it was brought to my attention by a couple of very fine human beings, one Dr. Issa Mustafa and Dr. Hani Sakar, who brought this idea from Muslim Clinic Ohio that was established in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
And then later on in Cincinnati. And they said, maybe, you know, you can do it here in Columbus, because they know that had been very innovative and established a lot of good courses in the Ohio State University curriculum for the medical students. So when they brought this idea to me, I said, okay, let me see what we can do. And I got physicians together and healthcare professionals, nurses together. And we had first meeting in my house. And later on, it's the history is, you know, everybody got excited that we are going to have a Muslim clinic, you know, because Muslims are wonderful people. Islam is a religion of peace, but we are always associated with some kind of disaster somewhere in the world. And so we wanted to establish an ongoing healthcare facility that will help people of all faiths, not just the Muslims. Muslim clinic is actually a misnomer, because it serves individuals who are underinsured and not insured, and whose income is very low. They cannot really provide. So
calling it the Noor Community Clinic, it's for the community.
For the community.
Yeah.
And it's Noor is light. Mm-hmm. And so it's a light of hope, light of healthcare for the community.
And you very strategically chose, you open the clinic on Wednesdays and the hours are in the evenings.
Right.
Tell me why that's important.
It's important because, you know, Ohio State had three other clinics going, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. The only day that was open was the Wednesday evening. Mm. And we decided to work on Wednesday evening for the simple reason there was a slot that was not filled.
Mm.
And Muslim Clinic Ohio took that slot.
Mm.
And I said, we're going to work on Wednesday evening. And it's run by physicians as well as the students are the real strength of a clinic. It's amazing. We have 100 medical students go through our program.
Wow, 100. 100, wow.
100 medical students who learn about empathy, sympathy, caring for multicultural population.
Yeah.
It's not just Muslim, but other cultures.
Well, so, the clinic is an opportunity for students to gain experience. How do you find the students to work there? Do they volunteer?
They all are volunteers. We have so many students, we cannot handle all of them.
Oh, wow.
Like, we used to have, you know, in the beginning, the Muslim student population was not that much. These clinics attract, just because we are Noor Clinic, Muslim Clinic Ohio, all the Muslim students want to come. And those who are undergraduates, who are Muslims, they have hope. They look at you. We are a role model for the healthcare professionals in the community, the younger generation. And they're motivated by the fact that we're doing so well. Noor Community Clinic now is the is the best, is considered, when you Google, is one of the top clinics in the country. University-affiliated Muslim-free clinics. There are two clinics, and the top clinics in the country are Noor Community Clinic and the Umar Clinic in Oakland, California. And therefore, I feel very good that we have, we are serving so about thousands of patients every year, and primary care as well as special care. But we inside the Noor Community Clinic, we have a women wellness clinic, a diabetic clinic, and we have a mental health clinic. Therefore, it's a combination of many subspecialities.
Yeah.
And we have wonderful physicians who dedicate their lives. They go out into the world at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they finish the hospital work, and they come to our clinic in the evening to do it.
Yeah, well, speaking of dedicating their lives to it, I feel like that is you in a nutshell. You have dedicated your life to this.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you moved to the U.S. from India in the 70s. So tell me about your background shaping the doctor you are today. Just like tell me about, you know, the little girl who grew up in India and how you became the doctor you are today.
Yeah. You know, as a little girl, I always wanted to be the best in terms of whatever I do, whether it's a meal that I'm helping my mom to cook, or whether it's a flower arrangement, or my studies, I couldn't be a second. I had to get my mother was so cognizant about giving her children the best education. I think the credit goes back to my mother. So I tell my grandchildren that it's a great grandmother who has made you what you are today, because she wanted me the best education. She put me through private schools. Even those days, she understood that, you know, the languages are very important. She has to learn. And my mother did not want the girl, especially we had three daughters and three sons my mother had, and she wanted the girls also to have as best education as the sons. Put me to private schools, and when my father was in the war a couple of times, the Second World War, as well as when there was a division going on between India and Pakistan. You know, he was in Pakistan at the time. And therefore, you know, my mother was the strong housekeeper and really made sure that we got the best education. I remember my mother made a lot of sacrifices when my father was not able to send the finances from when he was, when the separation was going on. She sold her bracelets and tore up her golden worked saris to melt into silver, and then pay the six children's tuition in private schools. And so that thing helped me. And then I was the first student in my high school, first student in my pre-university exam, got a gold medal there. And then I was selected to be, my parents did not, I had no role models to be a physician.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Okay.
Nobody even went to college, you know, because Muslim women, after they turned menarche, used to be had to be kept home and had a tuition. My mother had a tuition and a British lady to come and teach her English at home. So my mother realized how important this was. So she wanted us to all go to private convents. I went to St. Thomas's Convent. I went to Christchurch Convent. I went to Stella Maris College, all run by nuns. And so, any case, to make the long story short, coming back, my mother decided that when it was time for me to select my profession, I said, "What do you want to do?" My parents asked me. I said, "Well, I want to be a housewife. I want to go do home science." She said, "Well, you can do home science. You can be a good housewife, but also, I think God has given you the brains, and you've been top in the university, so maybe you should go into medicine." I thought I'd be old maid, medicine is so difficult. But she said, "No, you just try, because, you know, you have special talents. Go there for 2 months. If you don't like it, you come back." So that led to my admission to the medical school, and I loved it. I couldn't be what I am today if my parents had not introduce it in a positive way, and give me the freedom to choose what I want to do.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Knorr Community Clinic with founder Dr. Malika Huck, and we're talking about her life, basically. Can you tell me about maybe a special anecdote or an experience that sticks with you from all of your time working in these clinics, especially the Knorr Community Clinic? Is there something that sticks with you that you'll just, you want people to know about?
Every patient is, excuse me.
That's okay.
Every patient is fascinating. Every patient has stories. Mm-hmm. And we see sometimes many refugees who have left their homes and come. And they had everything, but when they come here, they have nothing, and they have to build their lives together. So one time we had a mother come in, and she was driven away from the home by her kids, and she said she had nowhere to go, and then we made sure that she was given a shelter and also taken care of physical as well as emotional needs. Mm-hmm. So that every patient has a story. And, our students and our physicians are very cognizant of the fact that these are the families that need a lot of not just physical care in terms of taking care of their health, it's different ailments, but also mental and emotional. So my students, when they go into the exam room, I have taught them, treat them with respect and with kindness, and follow their cultural values. Mm. Like a lot of my students who are not even Muslim, they greet them with Assalamu Alaikum, and that opens the door for them. Like, I used to go into Spanish families' room and say, hola. Yeah. And they will feel so happy. They'll start talking in Spanish. I said, oh. No English.
Yeah.
So therefore, the patients love us. The patients love us, and then later on they get healthcare and they move out. But some people just still want to stay there because they love the care they have gotten us. So my students and my doctors are wonderful, and they have made the Knorr Clinic under my leadership at what it is today.
What do you hope for the future of the clinic? Like, what are your dreams for it? Do you have a strong group of volunteers who can take it over? Like, what's going to happen in the future?
Okay, I'm thinking about it because I've been there for almost 18 years now. I have presented this to physicians individually. They said, Dr. Huck, this is too much. This is too much. You're doing four people's job. How are you going to do this?
Yeah.
I said, well, you can do it. So I got four physicians, four to five I'm focusing on, whom I'm going to distribute the work.
And it's going to take four or five people to replace one you?
Yeah. Four or five people. Because, they said they cannot devote that much time. Mm. And I said, you can do it. You can do it. What I did was I cut down on all my paying jobs. I focused mostly on Knorr Clinic because this is like my baby. And I said, it needs nurturing, caring. And now it's growing, it's got bringing fruits, like it's helping people. Mm-hmm. So you cannot ignore this. So I'm training four or five doctors to take over, maybe select one of them who will be able to assume the responsibilities. And I have to focus on other things as time is come. As we move along.
Okay.
So,
well, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for telling me about your life and about the clinic. We've been talking with the founder of the Knorr Community Clinic, Dr. Malika Huck, who has been a pediatrician in the area for more than 20 years and is the founder of the clinic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, and I loved it. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk to the producing artistic director of the Contemporary Theater of Ohio. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR. PR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. For Lita Hoffman, producing artistic director for the Contemporary Theater of Ohio, running a theater is more than just putting together productions. She joined the theater in 2020, and Lita has been the visionary for the theater's future and has been on a journey to build community connection through theater. She joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Lita.
Thanks for having me.
So what is a producing artistic director? That title sounds so fancy. What does the role involve?
Yeah, it's basically like being the CEO of a theater. So yeah. I'm the leader of the theater and making sure that everybody who works there, being it full-time staff and guest artists, are all working in the same direction.
Okay. So are you involved in day-to-day productions? Or are you trying to oversee
everything? Yeah. So I direct about half the shows we do every year. So I get to be really involved in the artistry of it. And I, at the end of the day, select the shows that we do. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, I'm also fundraising and figuring out marketing strategy and all of the administrative things.
All right. So I'm sure you have a team, but you're also are kind of a one-woman band.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you joined the theater in 2020. You moved from Chicago. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. That's an interesting year to move for
it
a theater
was.
Company.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like pandemic? Was it a pandemic
move? Yeah, it was a pandemic move. Everyone I interviewed with, I only met over Zoom, and it was months before I met most of the people I work with in person.
Yeah. What was it like, the idea of thinking of like taking a job running a theater company when no one could go to the theater?
Yeah, it was really crazy. You know, it was a chance to try to talk to people when we couldn't gather in the ways we were used to.
Yeah.
I think the nice thing about it, reflecting on it, was that everyone was innovating. Mm-hmm. Right? Everyone was just trying new things, figuring out what virtual theater looked like, figuring out other ways of gathering, other ways of having conversations. And so doing that at the beginning, in a weird way, was a blessing to sort of level set, figure out who I was in this leadership role, listen, and have time too, without, you know, doing full productions and all the scenery and costumes and all the things that go into it. I got to just talk mostly on Zoom to lots and lots of people from Columbus about what they wanted theater to be.
Yeah. I don't know if you were like on a job hunt and you interviewed for a whole bunch of jobs, but like what made you decide yes to the Contemporary Theater of Ohio?
A friend of mine reached out and said, hey, I'm helping the Contemporary find a new leader. I think you should apply.
Okay.
And I was settled in Chicago and running a company there and really happy. And so I actually went, I don't know, I'm not sure. And he said, Lita, you've got to talk to these people. And the conversations were so great, I ended up moving here.
So was your background in theater? Like, were you a theater kid?
I was definitely a theater kid. Yeah. I moved growing up a lot. And so I found community by being in the school play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plays, musicals, do you sing?
Both. I used to sing. I don't sing anymore.
Okay. Dance?
A little.
A little. So all the things. Do you have a favorite play you were in as a kid?
Oh, my gosh. I was in Our Town in high school.
Oh,
and I love that story. It was great. And sort of what I didn't know about that show and now know as an adult has been really fun to look back on.
Okay. So since joining the theater company, you have taken on more roles than just a director. You gave the theater a makeover. Tell me about some of those changes.
Yeah, you know, the pandemic really gave us a chance to have these conversations. And so we were called CATCO. Lots of folks in town know us as CATCO.
Yes.
A long history, right? Almost 40 years of history as CATCO. But as we were reaching out to new audiences and talking to people who'd moved here, that word and the acronym it had become, people didn't necessarily know we were a theater or what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took a very bold step after talking to lots and lots of people, and now are officially the Contemporary, which was in the acronym CATCO, but people just didn't know. And so now when we say, hi, we're the Contemporary Theater of Ohio, people know where we are and what we do.
Okay. When was the decision actually made to get rid of the CATCO acronym? Was it before you came?
No. This was while I was here. So
okay.
It was, I think, 2022.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's just an interesting thing because I was talking to a friend the other day and we were talking about going to the theater and stuff, blah, blah, blah. And they were like, whatever happened to CATCO?
Yeah.
Right?
So we're out here trying to teach people. Like, we're still here.
Yes.
We just changed our name.
Okay. Yeah. So how has that transition been going? Do you feel like it's growing pains or do you feel like a lot of people are, because someone like me, I've been in Columbus for 20 years.
Right,
so,
yeah.
You know, I still would maybe call you CATCO by accident. Yeah.
Yeah. I would people ask, can I still call you CATCO? Of course. It's great. But we've really found that it's brought a lot of new audiences to us. We're able to reach out to people and have people know who we are right away. Even just, you know, standing at Arts Fest a month ago and talking to people who are passing by. Some people are like, are you used to be CATCO? And then other people are like, oh, Contemporary Theater. I love Contemporary Theater.
Yeah.
And that spurs a conversation. So it's gone pretty well. It's a, you know, it's a scary thing to do, but to say we're going to change our name and please follow us. But people have been really supportive.
Okay, so now you're going to have to define contemporary theater for me. Yeah, do that.
Yeah. So as part of the process of the renaming, we also looked at our mission statement, our vision statement, and we really defined contemporary theater as relevant to the current moment. So every time that we talk about doing a play or a musical, me and my team, we have to sit down and go, does this feel like we know the answer to why right now? And a lot of that means that we are doing mostly shows that have been written pretty recently. That's the easiest way to make something relevant. But even if we're reaching back maybe 20 years, when we did 9 to 5, the musical, for example, you go, I know why we want to talk about gender in the workplace. And I know I want to do that now.
Okay. So contemporary can be something older, but it just speaks to our time in a different way.
And most shows, I mean, like our upcoming season, most shows, the oldest play would be, you know, 5, maybe 10 years old. So it's really the newest plays that are being written about who we are as a society. And we get to do them in Columbus.
Yeah. So tell me about finding new plays, right? Like, are you doing plays that are like off Broadway? Are you doing plays that have never even touched Broadway? And you, right, like that kind of thing.
Yeah. For the most part, we're doing shows that have just had Broadway or off Broadway runs. And then also trying to cultivate the new plays. So maybe about once a season, we'll do a show that it's its first production or its second production ever, and it's on the way to Broadway or on the way to more productions around the country. But next season, for example, we're doing a show called Eureka Day. It was written in 2018, but it had a New York productions, a Broadway run. It won a Tony, and now we're going to get to do it at the Contemporary.
This is Fascinating Ohio on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with the producing artistic director of the Contemporary Theater of Ohio, Lita Hoffman. So a part of your goal is to make theater more inviting and accessible. How do you do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's we're in a really intimate space. So the largest space we perform is 200 seats.
That's at the Rife.
At the Rife Center, right downtown.
Yeah.
So we're just across from the State House. We have free parking, you know. And so you get to come here and it's there's not sort of a grandeur of going to a theater like the Ohio. Instead, you're in this intimate studio black box and you're right there with the actors, which I find, especially for newer theater goers, is really exciting to really feel like you're there with the audience. And then, you know, we have lots of programs. We've got Pay What You Want tickets available for the first two performances of every single production, which is a great way to come try us out before paying full price for a ticket. And just, you know, ways of having talkbacks with actors, talkbacks with community members, so that it's not just coming to see a play. It's all about the conversation around it.
Tell me about marketing and getting people to know not just about your name change or who you are or what you do, but like to actually get the butts in the seats.
You know, we found that word of mouth is the most important thing. And at the end of the day, it's folks knowing about us and going, hey, I'm curious about that. And then eventually going, oh, I trust you. I want to be a subscriber, get tickets to all 4 shows. And, you know, so marketing is a lot of reaching out, a lot of social media, and just being in the right rooms and talking to people. The artists that we work with are great also at spreading the word about their shows. About 98% of the people we work with live here in Columbus or Central Ohio. And so, you know, it sort of spreads from friend to friend to friend that people have heard about this great thing. We've got a show coming up, A Jagged Little Pill, which, you know, the Alanis Morissette album, I'm sure you've heard of. So like that play will really help us meet new people because it's something that folks have heard of before.
Whenever you said 98% of your actors are local here. Okay. So how do you recruit the actors? Do you have just like a set of people? Do you have auditions? Or does that, do people who are just like, they have full-time jobs and they do the play on the side?
Yeah. So we do a big audition every spring and we cast out of that. So we invite everybody. We usually get about 300, sometimes 400 people who show up to audition for these parts. And we work with professional actors. So we work with both union and non-union actors. And it's really a mix, I find, in this community. People who, you know, are mainly actors and then they're gig workers and they're picking up coffee shop jobs, or actors who have full-time jobs during the day. And we always rehearse evenings and weekends so we can accommodate those folks. So people are doing 2 jobs at once and coming to rehearsal.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. So if do you cast based on availability too, or is it you're casting Like, you know, you have these 300 people auditioned. You already know the plays.
Yeah, we already know what the plays are going to be. You know, when I pick the plays, I go, I'm pretty sure we can find the people for this. And that 2% of people is, oh, I might need to house one of the actors if we can't find a specific role. But and we you know, and actors know before they audition when we rehearse. And so they decide what fits in their schedule.
Community and connection are some of your top priorities. How are you using theater to build community?
Yeah, you know, I really think that that theater and the arts are the way that we're going to build empathy and the way we're going to connect with each other. And it's my responsibility. I've done a lot of this work at Milwaukee Rep, is to think about community engagement. And what that means at the Contemporary is what we do next. So you come see a play. Hopefully you've seen a different perspective. You've thought about something you're thinking about in your own life in a new way. And then what? Mm-hmm. So that's about having resources in the lobby to take home. It's about the panel conversation afterwards with somebody who's doing that work in Central Ohio that touches on one of the topics of the play, working with community partners to bring folks to the theater who spend their day-to-day lives working in whatever issue we might be talking about. And so that work says, you know, this is going to be entertaining. It's going to be fun. We like to use comedy and music and all of the fun things about theater, but we're asking you to take the next step and just think a little bit as you're leaving the theater.
Nowadays, people can watch shows and movies with the click of a button. There's so many streaming services. But there's something special about seeing live theater. Talk to me about the human connection and how you get people off the couch.
Yeah. I think it is that human connection, especially how intimate our theaters are and how small they are. Mm-hmm. You are really there with the people. And you turn off your phone, right? I mean, I'm also guilty of sitting on the couch and watching TV while scrolling Facebook and we're doing too many things. And when you come to the theater, you say, hey, you know, this play is 90 minutes long and we're all going to be here together. Mm-hmm. And you can hear the person next to you laugh and you can feel the energy of the audience. Last year when we did Jia Jia's African Hair Braiding, we just had so many people talking to us about how they felt like they were in the hair salon. And it reminded them of places they'd been or they'd heard about. And I think there's just something so special about having the people in the room with you so that, you know, they can hear you laugh. They can hear you cry.
You do both plays and musicals, right?
Yeah.
So does each season just involve, like, you're like, okay, definitely two musicals, two plays, just a variety?
Yeah, usually we do one musical and then a series of plays. But, you know, this year we're doing a play with music, Where the Mountain Meets the Sea. So it's two actors and two musicians on stage together telling a story. You know, I find that it's really just what are the good stories that matter, that are going to matter to people in Central Ohio, that people want to hear? And then, you know, just trying to get a mix of styles so that some things are really realistic, some things are more stylized, some things have music, some things don't. So people get the breadth of what's going on in the theater right now in America.
All right. So you teased it, but I'm going to circle back to Jagged Little Pill because I'm an Alanis Morissette girl. You know, I had that album. I'm of the right age. Yeah. Very influential. So tell me how you ended up deciding that putting Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill on your stage was going to work.
Yeah. You know, we're always looking for shows that are really exciting and have hooks so that people like you have gone, oh, my gosh, I love that music. And then this show is so brilliant because it's taken her songs. You're going to get to hear most of the songs on the album plus more. And it's put a story behind it. So at the end of the day, it's a story about a family trying to figure out who they are. They're two teenage children, a mom, a dad, and they're going through the things that people are going through in the world. One of the main ideas, Jagged Little Pill, the mom is dealing with an opioid addiction after an accident. And so we get to use this platform that we have to say, hey, you're going to come. We're going to rock out and sing these beautiful songs. And we're also going to talk about the opioid crisis in Ohio, which is, you know, a major topic that I think we've all got to pay attention to and think about and help our neighbors out.
You also mentioned Eureka Day. Give me a brief synopsis of what that is.
Yeah. Eureka Day is a comedy about school vaccine policy. Which sounds
hilarious.
Not funny.
Hilarious.
And it is so funny because it's just...
Is that the name of the character, Eureka Day?
Eureka Day is the name of the school.
Okay.
And so it's a private day school, and they've all got to figure out what they want their vaccine policy to be, sort of a PTA-type group. But it's just... we just get to laugh at the terrible ways we talk to each other.
Oh, no.
Right? You know, how do we figure out how to come across divided ideas? Where do we find empathy? in this ridiculous comedy.
I can picture how you're going to market Jagged Little Pill and get people like mm-hmm. me to come, because you just have to say Jagged Little Pill and I'm there. Yes. How do you get someone to come see Eureka Day?
Yeah. You know, a lot of that just comes from our reputation that says, hey, trust us. You know, it's also, you know, it won a Tony Award. Some folks have heard of it from its New York run.
Yeah.
It's actually one of the most produced plays in America right now. So, you know, if you've got friends in other cities, maybe they've seen it and they tell you it's great. But I just get the fun job of saying, hey, it's a comedy about vaccines. I promise. It's really funny.
Okay. We have 2 minutes left. Yeah. What are your future plans for the theater? Are you trying, are there any future changes that you're hoping to still make?
Yeah, I think it's really more and more leaning into the community engagement piece of what we do. So I'm just looking to connect with more community organizations, really listen to what Central Ohio wants to be talking about, what things we have a great way to highlight, right? We've got thousands of people who are going to see our shows every year, and we get to say, hey, here's a thing I'd love you all to be thinking about and all to be talking about. And so just thinking of us as a community hub, as a convening space, and not just a space to see a performance, is going to be the next step of where we're headed.
How do you get people to differentiate you from like the Broadway Across America things that are coming to the Ohio Theater, which is across the street from you, literally, to you know, give something a little different a try rather than the Wickeds of the world?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we work with those folks all the time, we just we get to talk about the difference of space, so the different way it feels because of the size of the theater. You've got really high quality professional artists in both spaces. But when you come to the Contemporary, you're also getting that extra idea, right? Mm-hmm. You're getting the talkbacks, the panels, the think pieces. And we're just able to do shows that never get to go out Broadway tour. John Proctor's The Villain's my favorite play. We're doing it next year. Had an amazing Broadway run with Sadie Sink from Stranger Things in it. It is a show that didn't get a tour from Broadway. And so Columbus gets to see it because we were able to get the rights to do this show here.
You've been listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we've been talking with producing artistic director of the Contemporary Theater of Ohio, Lita Hoffman. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to All Sides and Fascinating Ohio. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.